Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Good Monday afternoon to you, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby, and my co-host today, and from now on, joining me, I'm really excited about, is Sophie Schlesinger. That was a Bob Dylan song that we led off with, because today we're continuing our State of Cheese series, and we're talking about Minnesota, home
Yay.
To... Exactly. Home to famous musicians like Bob Dylan and, of course, Prince, and, you know, to a burgeoning number of really excellent cheesemakers. And so I'm very pleased to announce our first guest, Jeff Jerick, who's owner and cheesemaker at Faribault Dairy in Faribault, Minnesota. Are you with us, Jeff?
Yes. Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thanks so much for being on the show today. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure to be on. I was enjoying that music, and that is a great connection to the opening.
Yeah, it said on the on YouTube that was recorded in a Minnesota hotel way back when. So we thought it was an appropriate one.
Brought back some great memories.
Oh, so tell us a little bit about what you do at Faribault. How did you come to be involved with them, and how long have you been making cheese?
Oh, let's see. I'm an old guy. I grew up on a dairy farm about 15 miles north of Faribault. And went on to school to get a degree in biology and came back home in December of 1979 to the family farm.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of days, I think my dad grew tired of me being back home, and he said, go find a job.
Happens with us all.
I was like, I did my job. Get out of here.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he had a friend in town, Don McComas, over in Faribault, who worked with the Minnesota Job Service at the time. And Don said, quote, unquote, they're hiring big guys down at the cheese caves. And so... at 6 foot and about 217 pounds at the time, I qualified for that. That was my resume. And I went to work here in Faribault scraping blue mold off of blue vein cheeses.
Fantastic. So, well, so the biology degree actually did come into play then.
It did eventually. What happened after about 3 weeks, they realized I had a degree in biology and they had an opening in the lab. So I became a licensed milk tester and grader and then a cheese analyst, and that led to a move out to Wisconsin where I learned how to make real Colby, real Jack, real cheddar.
And where did you learn that? What school did you go to?
Well, I was assigned to a plant in Wausau, Wisconsin, and my lead cheese maker was in the town of Hamburg, Roger Nofsinger. So I am today still a licensed Wisconsin cheesemaker, even though I reside in Minnesota.
Okay. I have one of my aunts lives in Wausau.
Oh, it's a beautiful area. My wife and I just loved it there. And we were sad to leave. We came back to Minnesota in about 1985, and I came back to this plant and eventually moved into production.
Uh-huh.
And then in 1991, the 80s was a decade of buyouts, and at that time, our company was owned by Swift & Company, which got merged or acquired by ConAgra. Anyhow, in April 15th of 1991, they announced they were going to shut this plant down because it was too small.
Oh.
So they outsourced the cheese to a firm in Wisconsin and moved the label over there, and this plant shut down for good in 1993.
Wow. That's crazy, huh? It's like a place with that much history. Because when did Faribault open?
Well, this place started out, believe it or not, as a brewery. You know, there's a lot of relationships there with beer that are kind of fun over the years, but it started out as a brewery in 1856, which was 2 years before Minnesota became a state, which is proof that us Minnesotans have our priorities right.
Exactly.
And then when Prohibition came along in 1918, the owners of the brewery decided not to fight it, and they shut it down. In 1936, a gentleman named Felix Fredrickson from, believe it or not, Wausau, Wisconsin, came along and he started up the plant again, and it became the first blue cheese plant in the United States.
Wow. Now that's interesting because, and so there's also, you know, a relationship traditionally with caves and blue cheese. So how did Mr. Fredrickson decide to do a blue cheese?
Well, that is, okay. He had been overseas during the war and was familiar with the caves of Roquefort in Mount Camembert.
Uh-huh.
And was intrigued with the natural humidity and the effect that had on the ripening cheeses. So when he came back to the United States, he'd heard about a rock formation known as St. Peter Sandstone. And long story on St. Peter Sandstone, it's named after the what is now known as the Minnesota River. And he came to Minnesota, going to St. Peter, Minnesota, which is where the rock formation is really well exposed, and was en route with his wife, Dorothy, when they stopped in Faribault, and he, in his own words, "I cast my eyes to the east and thereupon discovered what upon further investigation and proved to indeed be St. Peter Sandstone." We have that from his address in 1958 to the Rice County Historical Society, so I decided he's even more wordy than I am.
It was in fashion back then, you know? You had to admit, had to sound romantic.
Absolutely. And he began making cheese December 8th of 1936.
Wow. That is so interesting. Okay, so I totally got sidetracked, and I do this often, but so that is a beautiful introduction to how he started making cheese, and then right as we got off on that tangent, you were talking about how you came to be the owner of the Faribault cheese plant back in the early 90s.
Well, what happened was, after that experience of being shut down by a big company, I decided I was never going to work for a big company again, and so went to work and a couple of other related fields. But I could never get the caves off my mind because what we did was truly exceptional. And so I kept talking to, or periodically kept talking to one of the local banks about, gosh, wouldn't it be neat if you guys would borrow me enough money to open up those cheese caves again? And finally, through persistent effort, after about 9 years, they yielded, and with two other friends, we opened up the what we called Fervo Dairy Company in 2001 in May.
Wow! Wow! Congratulations! That is such a cool story.
Well, thank you.
I, as the owner of a very small company myself, I can sympathize with that, not wanting to work for a big company feeling.
Yeah. Yes. And so anyhow, we started up, and by the grace of God and through hard work and people that care in the artisanal cheese movement, we were able to continue growing it, and here we are today.
Well, and so can you tell us a little bit more about the cheeses that you make specifically, and do they relate to that original cheese made by Mr. Fredrickson?
Yes, they do. We're pretty proud of that. In fact, as we got a little bit older and had some money, we actually trademarked the phrase America's First Blue, because the recipe we're using, and you know, as much as there is a recipe, is indeed the original, as close as we can remember it. It's it is the real thing, and that's today what we call, you know, our marketing program's pretty simple because we're from Minnesota. So our flagship cheese is called St. Pete Select, after the St. Peter sandstone that it's aged in.
Very nice. Very nice. So St. Pete Select, and then I think I saw one other on your website. Is there another blue
another
cheese?
Another blue is Ama Blue, and again, got to remember I was a biology guy, so Ama is Latin for I love. And BLU is the technical name for the style of blue cheese that we make.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Oh, man. Well, I have to say, I'm sorry to say that I have never tried your cheeses. Out here in New York, I don't know, do you sell to anybody here in the New York area?
Yes, we're over at Murray's, and we're in the Wegmans, I can think of a couple other places that just, I never thought of researching that before I got on the line. Wegmans and Murray's for sure.
Okay, well, those are big ones. People can definitely...
And Artisanal. We're over at Artisanal, I believe, as well.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
And was that the Steve Jenkins I heard on the intro?
That was the Steve Jenkins.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. He is the best. He is the greatest guy.
I can still remember the very first time I met him was in 2001 at the American Cheese Society annual gathering. That year was in D.C.,
Oh, cool.
That man is a wealth of knowledge, and he's done a tremendous amount of work to advance the cause of us small cheesemakers.
Yeah, no, he's an incredible guy. You know, it's funny, I actually worked at Murray's Cheese back when I was first getting started in the cheese business, and on my very first day there, somebody gave me a copy of his cheese primer, which I faithfully kept, you know, next to my bed, and I would, you know, fall asleep reading about some sort of cheese every night before.
I can empathize with that comment. I can glance over my shoulder and see my dog-eared copy as well.
Yeah. So hopefully Steve will listen to this show and know how much we love him. Well, can you tell us a little bit more about the farms that you work with, that you source milk from? How many farms do you buy from? What size are they? Are they near the dairy?
Well, we've actually had a lot of things happen in the last year. We had, about five. All of our sourcing is grade A milk, and it's primarily from Holstein Herds.
Mm-hmm.
And we had seven local farms. In the about 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm sorry I don't have these dates down more, but we were intrigued with the grass-fed milk movement, and we began some work with Pastureland, a small co-op of, at that time, three farms about 30 miles away here in Minnesota. And I actually worked on a couple cheeses with them. One was a cheddar, which mm-hmm. was fun for us to make because we don't normally get to make cheddar.
Sure, yeah.
And then we also introduced a blue, which is our grass-fed blue is called Verdant. Again, simple marketing, verdant pastures.
Uh-huh. Hey, if it's simple, it works, yeah, it tastes works. Good. You don't need to make it complicated.
Exactly. And, and then that led to some more interest because we were in, I think curiosity is a great thing, and one of the most rewarding aspects of my career as a cheesemaker is that, I mean, it's limitless what you can study and what you can delve into. But at first I thought grass-fed milk was, you know, perhaps just another marketing thing, but then when we started making cheese with it, I realized, wow, this is different.
Hmm. What could you notice as a cheesemaker?
Well, the very first thing we noticed was, you know, the cheesemaker I've been training is Nick, and I'll never forget when we made that first vat of cheddar cheese with it. It was time to cut the curd, and we cut the curd, and when the curd separated from the whey almost had a greenish tinge to it. Huh. And Nick looked at me, and I looked at Nick, and I'm not a smoker, but I said, Nick, I think I need a cigarette. It was way different, pardon the pun. And that cheese, it was, at that point I realized, yes, the fatty acid profile was completely different than what we were used to seeing in conventionally fed milk.
Hmm. That's amazing. So, like, again, your biology and intense cheesemaker training, I'm sure, I feel like a lot of cheesemakers do things more by intuition. They haven't had that technical background. So it's interesting that you can put more of an exact, you know, qualifier on why that milk was different.
Well, one of the more profound things in that happens is, you know, they used to say back in the 80s when I was making cheese that cheese making is half art and half science. And what attracted me to it at the beginning was the science, because we were trying to be consistent, and consistency is the hallmark of great cheesemakers. And we were using science to help us do that, you know, to help us understand what the drivers were in the process. But it's the art that's kept me in the industry, because you are working with a living being. Those cheese are alive, and they respond to everybody that works with them. And that, you can't drive that out of the process unless you want to make dead cheese, and we all know what that's like.
Yeah. We've experienced it. We've seen the cryovac sad block somewhere.
Yes. Yes, the shelf-stable cheese. I always enjoy that. But anyhow, so that led us into playing with affinage, where we would bring other cheeses into the cave and see how they reacted, because that offshoot of the grass-fed experiments was we had done some aging on those cheddars, and we were developing notes that weren't typical, but that were fun. And so we now have three cheeses that we do the affinage, which is a French word for maturing of cheese. We do that here as well. One is a cheddar from my good friend Jeff Weidman, a master cheesemaker out of Monroe, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
That's a two-year-old that we then bring into the caves and cave age naked for several months. And then the next cheese after that was a grass-fed Gouda, which we've called St. Mary's. Again, simple marketing. Our caves are underneath the former Episcopalian school called St. Mary's.
Okay. So you got St. Peter's sandstone and St. Mary's school above. These cheeses are in good shape, I tell you.
Well, we're just, you know, we're always trying to, we feel like a part of the fabric of the community and the land that we grow our cheeses in. And so it's just natural for us to name them about the things around us. And, yeah, St. Mary's is a fun Gouda. It doesn't have a traditional taste because the grass-fed profile and the fats really does lend it to be a much softer and a less nutty cheese than the traditional Gouda.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because we were doing that and we're curious folk, we brought in a conventional Gouda that was made with conventional RBST-free milk. And that led to our latest, which is called Jeff's Select, making fun of the fact that Jeff Weidman and I both share the same first name. And then the tagline underneath it is Cheesemakers Without Borders.
That's a whole other show. The different Wisconsin and Minnesota. Who's got the better dairy?
No.
I won't even go there.
I am a proud member of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Brotherhood. Those people have been so supportive, and I get endlessly teased about why I don't move back to the motherland of cheese.
Well, we're happy that you're doing what you're doing over there in Minnesota. unfortunately, gosh, this always goes by too fast, but it looks like we have run out of time. But I would love for you to come back and be on the show. I feel like we've got to go further into more detail here because we only got the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, that'd be fun. I'd love that.
Well, thank you again for taking time to be on the show today, and we'll definitely be in touch and do Minnesota Revisited.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. I never meant to call you when you sorrow. I never meant to call you in pain. I don't want to watch that nasty laughing. I only want to see you landing in the purple rain. Purple rain.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., Chef Erica Wides hits the airwaves to become your own personal chef instructor. Chef Wides, along with esteemed guests from the culinary world, dissect topics that range from the complex to the deceptively simple, combining classic culinary know-how, personal experiences, and the occasional virtual history lesson. Why We Cook is a great listen for culinary vets and rookies alike. Again, that's Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby, and my co-host today is Sophie Schlesinger. So we are doing the State of Cheese in Minnesota and just had a really awesome sort of like mini karaoke fest with that Purple Rain song, because how can you not sing along to Prince? So in our second segment, we're going to continue discussing cheese in Minnesota with Benjamin Roberts, who works at France 44, a cheese shop that actually has two locations in St. Paul and Minneapolis. And Sophie is going to lead off the questions for this segment.
Yep. Hi, Benjamin. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So our first question is actually kind of, I guess, more logistical, and then I promise we'll get to cheese. But so can you just explain quickly, there are two locations, and my sister keeps telling me, who goes to college in Minnesota, you have to go to the St. Paul Cheese Shop. You have to go to the St. Paul Cheese Shop. But that, if I'm saying this correctly, is part of France 44?
That's correct. Our original location is located in Minneapolis. It's attached to a large wine shop. It's got much more of a big kind of suburban feel to it. And then about almost 2 years ago, we opened a second location over in St. Paul across from McAllister College, my alma mater. And a tiny little shop has much more of a congested New York City feel to it, which makes me feel right at home.
We can relate to that.
Yeah,
definitely. Yep. Not quite as small as your shop, Anne, but still pretty small.
Yeah, my shop, it's kind of, I feel like, you know, maybe we should apply for the Guinness Book or something. It's like, it's kind of ridiculous.
Most cheese per square foot or something. So, Benjamin, what's your role at the St. Paul Cheese Shop and at France 44?
So, my role is pretty much everything having to do with food with their businesses. I'm in charge of. So I do all the buying, marketing, organizing, running, planning, sandwich making, behind the counter, soup to nuts, of all anything involving food with France 44.
Cool.
Big job.
Yeah, you're pretty busy.
I am. Definitely having two shops makes it a little bit of a challenge, but it's also fun because I pretty much get to do whatever I want when I want to, so that's nice too.
And I'm a doofus. I should know this because I'm from the Midwest, but how far exactly are St. Paul and Minneapolis away from each other?
Well, they border each other, and they're divided mostly by the Mississippi River. Our two shops, I can drive without traffic 20, 25 minutes on the highway. So, you know, as the crow flies, it's not particularly far, but the France 44 is located on the very far southwest corner of Minneapolis, so it's kind of tucked away, far, far away in the dark corner of Minneapolis.
Cool. And then what about you? How'd you find yourself in the world of cheese, and how'd you end up in Minnesota?
I found myself in the world of cheese because I was managing a restaurant in Park Slope, Brooklyn, called Applewood, which New York people may have heard of. And
they
had a great artisan cheese plate there, and all domestic artisan cheeses, and it really caught my fancy. And ended up back in Minnesota because, like I said before, I went to school out here and wanted a bit of a slower pace of life than New York City, and it just seemed like a great spot to move back to. And I knew I didn't want to be in the restaurant business any longer. I enjoyed my time, but I was kind of done. I prefer the retail pace and hours, and so I happened to find the France 44 guys. They were in the process of retooling their food business, and I just approached them with a vision of what we could do with cheese out here.
Cool.
And what's the public's response been? I mean, do you guys, I guess that's a broad question. And then what are some of the cheeses that you sell the most of?
When I arrived here, there were a few cut-to-order cheese counters. And then since our arrival and opening two shops cut-to-order, three of them have closed. Two were run by the same owner, and then there was one other that closed. And so really for cut-to-order cheese shops, a new one just opened, but for a while there were basically the two that I ran and one other, and so that is a bit daunting in a town where there's a lot of grocery stores that do a decent job as grocery stores do with cheese, but we wanted to present something different. And coming from the East Coast, I felt like I had a lot of strong connections to East Coast cheesemakers that folks in the Midwest probably hadn't seen, and that was my big focus in the first year, was to sort of introduce some of the smaller East Coast farmstead cheesemakers that people out here maybe never had seen before, and it went great. It was a lot of fun.
Cool.
Who are some of those farms that you guys work with out?
My initial sort of excitement was to bring in the Cato Corner cheeses. That's Mark Gilman in Colchester, Connecticut, and I loved his cheeses. And you know, I dream of the Hooligan and the Bloomsday, and you know, and we brought those in straight off the bat. We introduced Nettle Meadow to this market, the Kunick. It really wasn't. I mean, I know Sheila's gotten bigger and bigger, but at the time when I was here, that cheese wasn't here, and we brought that into this market. And now
I bet people are like kissing your feet when you like walk down the street. They're like, oh my god. I feel like people have a particular reverence for Kunick.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. When it's on, it's just fantastic, and people were really, really excited, and we had, you know, that really helped build our brand here when people knew that they were the only place in town where, you know, we were the only place in town where they could come and get that cheese, and,
sure.
And that was fantastic.
And what about the cheeses that you carry in the shop? How do you kind of decide which ones you'd like to have? And what about any cheeses from Minnesota that you're enjoying right now?
You know, it's a struggle. When I originally started buying for the case, my goal was to be about 70% domestic farmstead cheeses and 30% imported, and I've watched that kind of flip-flop as we go with what the customers want. I wish I could run my ideal case, but we also want to make a living and stay in business, and so So now, you know, we still push, and we still have great luck with domestic farmstead cheeses, but just not as many as we used to ratio wise. But we can still do really well, and we're still always, you know, we bring in Sweetgrass Dairy Green Hills from Georgia in the wintertime. People love those. We've been doing a lot of work with Consider Bardwell in Vermont, and we have good luck, and we started bringing in stuff from Blue Ledge in Vermont, and so that's great. And then, you know, in terms of Minnesota cheeses, I mean, we have a few, but not a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We were just chatting with Jeff Jerick of Faribault Dairy.
Yep.
Do you guys sell any of their blue cheese?
You know, we don't. I mean, I've met Jeff and have had some great conversations with him, and I actually really like his cheeses, but his cheeses are so ubiquitous out here, and you can get them in so many places, and we're just so, we've got, you know, our sort of slight amount of space compared to what the grocery stores carry that it just didn't feel necessary to represent his cheeses in our case. But it's not for any lack of enjoyment of those cheeses. It's just they're everywhere in the cities here.
Cool. I'm going to have to hunt him down. I haven't tried any of his cheeses, so yeah. I'm very excited to...
He's just one of the grandfathers of Minnesota cheese here, and I hate to say that because he's not a very old guy, but he does a great job. His cheeses are fantastic, and he's even come out with, you know, some cheddars and things now that are really, they're quite nice.
Cool. And what about your customers in the shop? Are they adventurous about trying new cheeses, or how do you kind of get people to branch out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the two stores are in two totally different neighborhoods. The clientele in each store is completely different, and so the manager of the Minneapolis store and I really, you know, try and egg each other on to see who can sell the more challenging cheeses. And then we try and pit the St. Paulites against the Minneapolis folks, because there is somewhat of a sibling rivalry between the two towns.
Right.
So we always like to, you know, pump each other up and say, whoa, we sold a ton of this in St. Paul. I mean, you know, you guys should buy it too. And so... but I would say overall, we actually have pretty good luck. I mean, I can sell things like Hooligan, and there are people looking for those cheeses. And you know, that's fun. We don't just have to sell Gouda to everyone.
Yeah. Gouda is very lovable.
It is very lovable, and I have six different kinds in my tiny little case. But it's nice to sell something different sometimes.
Sure.
So I have a question. What about any kind of like Minnesota cheese festivals? Do you guys organize any events, or are there any kind of Minnesota cheese shindigs that we should know about?
Yeah,
it's hard. You know, as you know, there's a state next door to us called Wisconsin.
and then you guys got to, like, you know, I can see an even bigger battle if St. Paul and Minneapolis is one. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, and so, you know, Minnesota unfortunately gets overshadowed in some ways by the production of cheese from Wisconsin. There are some new cheesemakers in Minnesota, and we're excited about that. I mean, there's certainly no lack of dairy here. There's sheep, there's goats, there's cows. I mean, there's plenty of space. It's an agriculture state. There's just not a grand tradition of cheesemaking here. And we would love for that to change. We would love to see more people in our backyard making delicious cheese that we want to sell in our shop.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to folks like yourself, I'm sure that will be the case, because, you know, as people begin to, you know, the demand rises with what people eat. So
right.
Absolutely. And of course, local is hot, and we always get people asking us for local cheeses, and certainly, you know, Wisconsin is very well represented in what we do here. And, you know, and Minnesota hopefully will continue just to increase here.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for taking the time out to be on the show with us today. Unfortunately, the half hour always goes by too quickly.
Yeah.
But thanks again. And when I am next in the Midwest, I'm going to come seek out your cheese shops. Head over to Minnesota.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks. We look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
We'll see you next week on Cutting the Curd.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. The Snacky Tunes compilation has arrived and is available for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. This compilation features live performances from some of the hottest acts around today, including Midnight Magic, Surfer Blood, Oberhofer, and more. Again, you can download this compilation for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and make sure to listen to Snacky Tunes every Monday at 2 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.